So this is our reading group, continuing our reading of neo-finalism. So yeah, we're in the chapter Absolute Domains and Finality, and we're picking up from page 114 of the translation. Yeah, so we just started this chapter last time. Yeah, so this has to do with his notion of absolute domain or absolute overview, etc. These are domains that have this sort of self-presentation quality or property to them. So the sort of stock example that comes up over and over again is that the retina sort of has a representation of objects outside of it, that are, the light that's projected onto the retina, but there isn't a sort of second eye that looks at the retina, that looks at the image projected on the back of the eye, and then sort of sees it. The retina or the visual system as a whole is a kind of self-presenting domain. It doesn't need something else outside of it to look at it. And this is sort of like typical for what an absolute domain is. It doesn't need something external to itself to be sort of presented. And he in a previous chapter he gave us little one of his little diagrams that are sometimes pretty funny, of like the landscape painter sets up the easel and canvas and is painting this landscape, and then realizes, oh, I didn't include myself in the painting, so I better draw a little easel and canvas, etc. And then of course on the drawn canvas that is in the painting, that person, the painter, would have to include another smaller canvas and a painter and so on. Again, it's sort of like the Borax box, infinite descent of representations kind of thing. And so this is not how visual perception or any of these like absolute domains work. So a canvas, of course, doesn't perceive whatever is painted on it. So you need to have an external eye or an external perceiver that looks at the canvas, but the retina is not a canvas or anything like a canvas. The visual system is not a canvas. There's no like third eye or spiritual eye or whatever that looks at the visual system and then says, oh yeah, I see a house or whatever. The visual system just is the seeing itself. So this is sort of like his concept of an absolute domain. And then so he talks about some of the kind of properties of an absolute domain. One is that an absolute domain consists, or what is sort of depicted or pictured or presented in an absolute domain is a thematic form and not just a sort of spatiotemporally realized shape. So in the case of visual perception, for example, we perceive objects and not just geometrical figures, although we also can perceive a figure like a triangle or whatever, but when we perceive, even if it's something like just a triangle projected on a screen and you're just sort of looking at it head on in some kind of psychology lab or something like that, you're not just sort of passively receiving light striking your retina and then undergoing some sort of physiological process. What's happening is you're actually grasping, for example, the lines as separating the inside and outside of the triangle, or you're sort of recognizing the triangle as a figure against a background, etc. There's this structure to what it is you're perceiving, even in the case of these very simple geometrical figures. And then even more so in sort of real life perception, when you watch a person walk down the street, you're recognizing that there is a person. You're separating the shape of this person from the background. You're tracking the body moving in space, etc. Like all these different sort of structures are what it is that you're grasping when you see someone walk down the street, and it's not just a matter of a change of stimulation of cells in your retina or something like that. And then another element that he, or another sort of characteristic of these absolute domains that he points to is this kind of, we could call like a modal quality to it, meaning that when we grasp something you know, by means of, or, you know, in connection with one of these absolute domains, we are not just grasping what actually is, but also what is possible and necessary. So his example is maybe not super straightforward, but he talks about shapes of letters and sort of the capacity to grasp whether it's possible to cut out the shapes of these letters without sort of lifting the scissors off the page. So in the case of a letter like the letter N, you can just sort of cut out this piece of cardboard or whatever it is in sort of one continuous scissors slicing operation. Whereas the letter A, for example, has this sort of internal triangle or this internal hole in the middle of it. And so you can cut out the whole outline, but then you would have to sort of like punch a hole through the page in the middle and then use that hole to cut out the triangle in the middle. And so, yeah, there's no way to get into that middle hole of the letter A without either, yeah, punching a hole perpendicular to the surface or slicing through one of the sides of the letter A or whatever. But anyway, you can sort of recognize the possibility of performing certain types of cutting operations on a surface. And it's precisely this sort of grasp of possibility that is characteristic of an absolute domain and not just a sort of step-by-step or mechanical operation. And then I think the last one we looked at had to do with temporality. So here, this is kind of like the retroactive character of human actions or anything that has this sort of finalistic nature to it. One of his examples here is, you know, the question of, you know, is the French Revolution finished? You know, this is a sort of live question, you know, throughout the 19th century in France. You know, if you are, say, a monarchist, you might say, you know, the French Revolution, you know, happened and, you know, thankfully now we're done with it. It's you know, in the past. Whereas if you're a Republican, you might think the French Revolution has not been completed and needs to be sort of pushed forward to its completion. And then, of course, depending on what ends up happening, you know, whether the monarchy persists or there's a new republic, as, you know, actually did end up happening with the Third Republic, you know, that sort of retroactively changes the sense of, you know, what was done in that in the 18th century French Revolution. It's either, you know, it can become either, you know, this sort of aberration that was undone once the monarchy was restored, or it can be sort of like the first step towards the eventual foundation of the Third Republic. So yeah, that, you know, what happens decades later or almost a century later when the Third Republic is founded, sort of retroactively changes the sense of the French Revolution in the 18th century. And this is not just true of, you know, grand historical events like the French Revolution, but even, you know, sort of basic things that, like, you know, if you, I don't know, if you, you know, do a job interview and you get the job or don't get the job, you know, that sort of outcome retroactively changes the sense of your performance in that job interview. You know, it's either, you know, the start of your brilliant career or, you know, just one dead end among many. So yeah, any sort of action it retroactively acquires sense based on what happens to it afterwards. And this also can extend beyond the lifetime of the person who does it. It can be, you know, your children or, you know, people who discover your work after your death or whatever that, you know, make what you did have a certain meaning or significance that it didn't have during your lifetime. Okay, so I think we can pick up from there. He's going to continue on this topic of the temporal structure of an absolute domain from the top of 114.
I can read. For the individual, the mental survey of time is limited to the duration of his life. But within this limit, ubiquity is realized all the more clearly. Humans can, at the last moment, ruin or save a long friendship or a long fidelity. They can compensate for a long negligence. If this last moment is just a physiological or psychic crisis, there is no virtue in its recurrence. It must have a mental sense so that it alters the meaning of life as a whole by surveying it. In reality, religions are not mistaken in their belief that a final repentance effaces all sins. Although simple minds like the Emperor Constantine are wrong to imagine that a cunningly delayed baptism can exert a magical action and expunge all crimes. Whereas in the order of space, even at the level of perception and psychic thematism, the sense of the surveyed form is immediately everywhere. A difficult symbolic assembly and a mental culture are needed in the order of time, for sense to attain a relative temporal ubiquity. The purely psychic, spontaneous temporal attitude is not null, even in animals. Pavlov's dogs can be conditioned by the rhythm of a beat, by a melody. Humans can understand as a unique whole, a long sentence with a crucial word, which retrospectively supplies the key to the total sense, is placed at the end. A musical phrase depends on its final notes, and even a relatively long movement in a symphony can depend on its last harmonies. For time as for space, albeit to an unequal extent, the absolute domain is given with life, and the superstructures that the various techniques add to it are grounded in this primitive donation. The significance of these considerations for the problem of finality can be easily understood. If we were to understand the structure of time according to the schema of classical physics, the idea of finality would become a pure absurdity, like the telepathy toward the past of Stapledon's Neptunian. Finality is compatible with a series of actions ordered step by step. There is a, quote, step by step, unquote, inherent in time, at least in the macroscopic time of physics, in which one instant ceaselessly succeeds another. Although even a physical body can move here and there within a proper domain of space and return to its point of departure, where it eventually rediscovers and modifies its own traces, a physical body is swept away in time without return. I wonder if that should say physical. Once space and time are fused, the irreversibility of time renders meaningless the return to the point of departure in space. The quote-unquote universe line obviously excludes every recurrence and every finalist organization. But as we have already noted, the domain of absolute survey does not have the same structure as the space-time of physics. Here, in contrast, the absolute survey of space entails, with some supplementary difficulties, the absolute survey of time. Already, organically and psychically, I do not live exclusively in the present. I am always in the process of accomplishing an action or a labor that simultaneously anticipates the future and modifies the sense of the past. Despite the quote-unquote step-by-step of the succession of instants, which manifests the underlying reign of physical realities and aggregates, I do not enter the future with closed eyes. The present is not a block from which my free activity launches itself into the void. To some extent, we can choose our path in time, as we can decide between various itineraries in the surveyed space, thus avoiding future obstacles that can be identified with various symbolic procedures. To avoid taking a train on Saturday because the next day there would be no connection to the desired destination is not essentially different from the avoidance of an obstacle by an animal that alters its trajectory before it stumbles on this obstacle. The detour on the basis of innumerable virtual trajectories is equally possible in time. These paragraphs tie in nicely with sort of one of the themes of, I think, this reading group, which is the melody gestalt. One of the examples that Merleau-Ponty gave in structure of behavior against the reflex arc theory was that the behavior of rats in mazes can't be understood unless sort of the sense of the successful completion of the maze retroactively changes the sense of the whole maze, or the maze that led to the successful completion. Because the rat doesn't, for instance, just exactly reproduce the path that, you know, got it to the end. It takes shortcuts once it knows the right way to go. The point about the taking a train where you have a connecting train is similar, but forward looking. So our ability to carry out what he refers to as various symbolic procedures enhances our capacity to avoid obstacles, but it's not really different in kind from the way an animal can avoid an obstacle, a physical obstacle.
Yeah, like even like for the rat example, you can think of, like, you know, the rat learns to navigate a maze where there's like a say a left and a right branch, and it tries the left branch first and then runs into a wall, and then, you know, tries the right branch and gets the food at the end. If you put the rat in the same maze again, it won't sort of trace its path through the left branch and then come back and only afterwards go down the right branch. It will just avoid the left branch altogether and and go to the right branch. So it doesn't just sort of like, you know, physically reproduce the series of steps that it took in the first run where it eventually got to the goal. It, you know, through that exploration, it has sort of learned that the left branch is a dead end. And so like those steps that it took on that first run that led down the left branch are sort of like retroactively qualified as being wasted, and then it can avoid wasting time and effort going down that left branch and just go straight down the right branch. And so this is the kind of thing that Merleau-Ponty was pointing out. It's hard to explain from this sort of reflex perspective, because if you just if you take it that like the rat is just sort of like the behavior that was rewarded is just getting sort of mechanically reproduced by that, you know, reward, you should find that the rat would just do the exact same thing as it did the first time, including that unnecessary detour down the left branch, which of course is not what happens. The rat is smarter than the reflex theorists would maybe suspect. It is able to avoid doing things that didn't contribute to getting the reward. Here, Rieu points out that this sort of this like temporal structure is kind of built into everything that we any of our perception. So we can connect this with you know, like Husserl's discussion of retention and protension. So just to be able to, you know, see a table and you know, see it as a table, as a physical object, you're anticipating that you will be able to, like, that if you sort of walk around the table, you will, you know, continue to see the sort of correct table shapes. And then if you were to see a table and then walk around it and then discover it was actually this like super realistic cardboard cutout, you would be surprised. And that sort of discovery, this surprising discovery, would retroactively change the sense. So even though you thought you were seeing a table at first, you have learned that you were actually just seeing this cardboard cutout all along. And then, of course, you know, the what you're perceiving now has to be sort of connected to your previous perception, so that like you can, after you've walked around the table and you see it from the other side, you have to sort of be able to grasp that this is the same table as you were seeing, you know, 3 seconds earlier from the front. And so there's this kind of temporal linkage, you know, linking back to what I just perceived and what I am about to perceive, that is constitutive of what it means to see an object as a physical object, and as a specific type of physical object. Of course, you know, a cardboard cutout of a table is still a physical object, but it's not the kind of physical object that we thought we were going to see or that we were expecting. Yeah, so this sort of anticipatory and retentive structure is part of even the most basic perception, and I think there's even been like studies on, I think, like newborns, you know, within a couple hours of being born, where they you know, show them little cartoon videos where, like, you know, a certain number of objects, like say three circles, move behind a sort of barrier, a big rectangle or whatever, and then only two of them come out on the other side, and the infant, you know, sort of reacts with surprise when, you know, the third one doesn't come out, for example. There's already this kind of expectation of what's going to happen. It's already sort of there, you know, within a few hours of birth, and so even this like extremely sort of simple scenario of these like little cartoon figures is it's only like comprehensible or graspable through this kind of anticipation of what is going to happen, and then, you know, surprise if that doesn't turn out to be correct.
Yeah, I think I don't, for this section, this is kind of common when I'm reading Ruyère in this book, but going through it again this time, he seems to be making something sort of a statement here that's more profound than it might seem on the surface about our about time and our experience of time, or the experience of time for these absolute surfaces, I suppose. But that sort of like space, it's not really bound by the present alone, and that it can't be moving through time in the strictly Einsteinian sense of space and time. And I mean, I guess that can sort of seem simple, but I don't think it's not just simply like some mystical pretension he's saying here, but more that we can sort of move through time in the past and in the future, simultaneous to the activity that is being undertaken, placing the value of the activity over the pure material structure of it, I guess. I don't know. We had a time change last night, so it's still really early here, but
yeah,
I feel like he's saying something. I feel like he's saying something. He's kind of hinting at something here that's a little bigger than what it seems on the surface.
He was probably giving us an argument for why we shouldn't use daylight savings time. And that's probably what was going on here.
That's another reason to like him.
Yeah. The sort of like, so he the example that he gives here of like the, you know, looking at the train schedule and deciding, oh, I'm not going to take the train on Saturday because then I can't make there's no connection for me to get to, you know, the next place where I'm trying to get to. You know, this is a kind of temporal detour that is analogous to, you know, the detour that you might make where, you know, your road, there's construction on the road you usually take. So you take a physical detour and use a different road. There's not really any difference in principle between these two cases. In the one case, you have like, you know, the obstacle is actually present in front of you. And then you take a detour to avoid it. But in the second case, the obstacle is anticipated. It's something that would happen if you were to do X, and then you can, you know, avoid that obstacle by not doing X, or, you know, by doing something different instead of what you would have done. And yeah, so this is a kind of time travel, if you want to use that word in a very sort of loose sense. So like your sort of anticipation of a future in which you did take the train on Saturday allows you to avoid the, you know, getting stranded in some small town that only has one train on Saturday or whatever. And here, of course, you know, time travel, not in a physical sense, because you don't actually have to, you know, get to that scenario where you're stranded in that town. You can sort of anticipate that would happen and then avoid doing that. And this, of course, time travel in this sense is not bound by any sort of you know, speed of light considerations or whatever. We can you know, investigate what happens you know, at the Big Bang, you know, or, you know, in the immediately after the Big Bang, even though there's, you know, a lot of limitations on what we can know about that, it's something that we can still, you know, it still makes sense to like think about what happened, you know, at the Big Bang or even before the Big Bang. You can have that thought, even if it might not end up ever being possible for us to know what that was. Or that thought might end up, you know, not really making sense. We can still at least sort of put that thought to ourselves and, you know, mentally travel into the past, you know, many billions of years before, you know, life existed on Earth or anywhere else, as far as we know.
An interesting point that Paul Churchland made in that Plato's Camera book, he was talking about Hebbian learning and sort of this recurrent, like top-down neuronal action, which he says can explain, kind of physically explain anticipation, where you have, at least as I understand it, in very simple form, you know, some some neural activation pattern at like layer one, and then the passage of this the excitatory pattern from one to two, but also a sort of a movement back down to layer one, which has the effect of this kind of, it means that the recurrent or top-down stimulus can sort of fire at the same time as the lower level stimulus. And if that connection becomes very strong, then the lower level neuron can sort of expect some higher level activation pattern whenever it encounters a given activation pattern. But yeah, the upshot was that this, you know, a lot of this happening on multiple levels, sort of across, you know, brain modules all the time, can explain predictive behavior and the fact that, you know, as in the Husserl protension retention example, you know, object recognition is always transtemporal. And it seems like, you know, I find myself wondering, you know, what Rouillet's response to that kind of framing would be, whether he would say, you know, well, you know, even if that can, if this kind of recurrent action can account for, you know, relatively simple object recognition, it's still not entirely clear how it accounts for sort of these very, very complex, like reasoning chains and thoughts about, yeah, like the origins of the universe, which, you know, don't only have a very highly mediated relation to anything that we've ever physically perceived. Or if he, you know, if he might say like, well, it's not surprising that that neuroscience can account for some of these transtemporal forms, because, you know, my whole point is that you need to account for this kind of phenomenon in order to account for, you know, animal behavior, for instance, and that the neuroscientific account is what we would expect, you know, sort of the third person and objective explanation of the nervous system to eventually converge on. But yeah, I don't know. I know in a couple of places he's also said, he's pointed out that even, you know, like amoeba, for instance, have relatively simple or comparatively very simple, improvisational and sort of predictive and responsive behavior, and that the embryo as well, which doesn't have a nervous system, also sort of has detour behavior of a kind. So, yeah, I don't know, just something I was thinking about when reading this, Rie's point about a transtemporal aspect of absolute survey.
Yeah, I suspect his response to that would be to point to the kinds of equipotentiality arguments that he's gone through in a lot of detail in earlier chapters, that like you can potentially explain specific instances of anticipation in terms of you know, learned responses, you know, Hebbian learning or some similar sort of mechanistic sort of learning system. But I think he would point to the fact that you can potentially learn, or the sort of range of things that you could have potentially learned is wide enough that it seems implausible to assume that there is some sort of like pre-existing connection that only has to be sort of reinforced or strengthened or whatever to, you know, to bring about that anticipation. So I mean, even the case that, like, you know, human learning, of course, is, you know, a whole different topic, because it involves, you know, learning through linguistic means and so on. But if you look at, like, you know, other animals' capacity to learn things, like, you know, anyone who has a pet, I'm sure, will have, you know, stories about how, like, they learn some bizarre pattern that you would never have picked up on, that, like, oh, when this person does this, that means that, like, this other person is going to do this thing, or, like, you know, when this kind of car drives down the road, then that means that, you know, this person is going to come home soon or whatever. Like, yeah, they learn all these like patterns that no one else, like a person would never pick up on. And it's precisely that capacity to, you know, learn these patterns that, yeah, have this like very, that has a sort of arbitrary connection. There just happens to be this correlation that they can pick up on. I think that's the kind of thing that Ruyer would point to as indicating that, yeah, this anticipatory ability, it has to be primary, and then the sort of realization through something like Hebbian learning would be like one sort of way in which that capacity is realized, but not like a full explanation for that capacity itself. Just one small point before we move on to the next passage. He mentions in that bit that we just read this idea about baptism. This is a reference to sort of a widespread belief in the early centuries of Christianity that like baptism sort of washes away your sins from your life, your pre-Christian life. But it's like much worse to you know continue to commit sins after baptism. And so the conclusion that many people who were, you know, sort of interested in Christianity in those early centuries drew was that you should delay baptism as much as possible. You should like the best idea is to, you know, get baptized on your deathbed, and then you don't have any chance to commit sins afterwards, which is probably not exactly what the intention was. And so Ruyer is sort of pointing to this here, that, you know, this is kind of like a sort of magical conception of what baptism does. It is sort of, it's this, you know, like pressing the reset button on your sort of moral inventory or whatever. And yeah, you just have to sort of strategically time it to make sure that you don't accumulate any sins after pressing reset. So here, he you know points in this passage to the idea that, you know, this, you know, baptism can have this, you know, sort of retroactive effect on your previous life, you know, your life of sins beforehand. You know, baptism could be the sort of moment where your whole life changes and you retroactively sort of wash away your sins, but it not by virtue of some, you know, magical resetting of the you know moral stockpile. It's rather that you know in the same way as any other event or action can retroactively change the sense of what happened before, and so there's no, you know, sort of advantage to delaying baptism, you know, to avoid accumulating sins afterwards. It's the same. You know, baptism here has the same sort of retrospective or retroactive power as any other decision or action that affects the sense of previous actions. Organelles, would you like to read from Once Completed on page 115?
Can I read next in order today?
Yeah, no worries. I can read the next one. Once completed, the chosen path has something definite about it. From that moment onward, the other possible paths I could have realized have a twice imaginary pseudo-existence. In pure space, if I arrive at an impasse, I can return to my point of departure and restart. The method of trial and error is appropriate. In time, I can retrospectively alter nothing more than the sense, meaning, of my past conduct with the sense I superimpose on it. Nevertheless, the historian can hypothetically reflect on what could have been. And he has to do so if it is true that every historian investigates what could have been to understand what was. To understand the path that an animal takes, if one is not a dogmatic behaviorist who only seeks to use causes for explanation, is always to see it on the basis of, quote-unquote, because otherwise. The animal passed by here because otherwise it could not have attained the goal. Quote-unquote, euchronia is always more difficult to imagine than, quote-unquote, utopia, and it is always more artificial, yet it is not impossible or absurd. Every comprehensive science is always based on the possible, on quote-unquote utopia. Every social or individual history is always based on quote-unquote uchronia. Utopia and uchronia are conceivable only through the notion of a domain of absolute survey. I'm going to stop here because we have the next letter in this list. So yeah, this is just sort of building on what we were just talking about earlier. And this is, I think, a good illustration that, you know, this sort of retroactive character or the sort of the need to appeal to something beyond this mechanical causation is not sort of limited to human action. It's not just when we're, you know, explaining what a person does that we need to, you know, make reference to anticipation of future obstacles or, you know, alternative possibilities and so on. Even in the case of, you know, explaining why, you know, a squirrel, for example, took, you know, path A instead of path B to get back to its burrow or nest or whatever. Just by virtue of like setting up the problem as, you know, why A rather than B, you're already sort of presenting an alternative or a possibility. You're saying, you know, paths A and B were both possible, but the squirrel took A instead. So, and then you sort of try to find an explanation for it. You say, you know, if the squirrel had taken path B, it would have, you know, put it in danger because of, you know, X phenomenon, whatever, you know, there's a predator nearby or whatever. So you're appealing to, you know, a possible alternate path that the squirrel didn't take. And that's how you sort of understand why it took the path that it did take. So this is a pretty sort of trivial, kind of explanation, I guess, but any type of, you know, observation of the behavior of animals or, you know, even, you know, physiological processes, you know, why was this hormone released at this time and not some other hormone, et cetera. Like, you're always understanding something with reference to alternate possibilities. You're trying to explain why did this happen instead of, you know, these other things that could have happened. So this is always this sort of background of potential alternatives is always there. And then when you're trying to explain what did happen, you're sort of identifying, you know, what it is that brought about the actual chain of events and not the other possible ones.
I can read if you still need some time, organelles. D, choice and work. Provided we set aside the problem of the eye, substantialized unity of the domain, it is not difficult to show that the absolute domain is a necessary and virtually sufficient condition of freedom and work activity. We've already seen that the two notions of freedom and work are indissociable. Freedom and work presuppose, on one hand, the vision of a value or an ideal to be realized, and on the other, the choice of the means of realization. The two opposite notions, equally correlative to each other, are those of causal determinism, atergo, and pure functioning, without ideal or possibility of choice. An automaton fitted with an artificial retina or cortex, like the photoelectric screen we have described, or even fitted with homeostats, like those of W.R. Ashby, can neither aim beyond the actual nor choose its means. Innumerable atomic automatic devices, which make use of quote-unquote information on perforated tapes and are already employed by life insurance companies, are essentially designed to select, to sort, to quote-unquote choose, and they discharge their task better than a man could, who is replaced by them as much as possible and is guided in his conscious choice by the quote-unquote automatic choice. But of course, the automaton quote-unquote chooses only according to the assembly realized in advance by the engineer. The most sophisticated device can only sort and differentiate. It cannot truly choose. An ordinary scale will, quote-unquote, know better than I can which of two objects is heavier, but I am the one who chooses the heaviest or the lightest according to the needs of the moment, which are a function of my reference through my field of consciousness and to an order of ideal values. I am the one who chooses to use a scale as a pure means. The machines that verify the caliber of bearing balls by placing the quote-unquote good ones in one cabinet and the bad ones in another, or bad ones in another, can only choose according to a predetermined assembly. The engineer incorporates the true choice into the assembly itself. Only a domain of survey can choose, because the two objects to be differentiated exist together and distinctly in the subjective field, and because these objects are referred back through the thematic and signifying character of true forms, not to an extremum, but to an optimum. An automaton does not have freedom of choice, and correlatively, it does not work, except in an entirely metaphorical sense. Work proper always consists in establishing and improvising bonds and not in operating according to pre-established bonds. It consists in the quote-unquote assembly, in the active sense of the term, of bonds and not in operating according to an assembly, in the passive sense of the term. Cerebral work proper and cerebral fatigue probably imply that the neural cells are the initial supports of the assembly improvised by consciousness. The mental norm is transformed into a psychic quote-unquote task. This task tends in its turn to be transformed into material physiological bonds that function automatically. The act of choice becomes an organ of automatic sorting. Fatigue does not appear at the first mental stage, the pure aim. It disappears at the third stage, when the mechanism is established. It is inherent to the second, psychobiological stage, because consciousness is then literally incarnated, serves as an improvised bond, and constitutes a unified system, perhaps removing energy from neural cells in accordance with a well-known principle. The interaction between a system's elements diminishes their individuality. Yeah, this is a very interesting argument. And this gets to your point earlier, Nan, about Rouillet's answer to Churchland. So the Hebbian learning, or the the weighting that has been established by the Hebbian learning would probably correspond to this third stage, where the work of instantiating the form has kind of already been done, and then prior to that, you have this first stage, which is, he says, it's pure aim, which is the moment of freedom, I guess, and the freedom and work pair, and the moment of like maximum equipotentiality. And then this this ideal or equipotential whole gets instantiated in the second stage, which is where he says the work is done. And then if it's, I guess, done enough, it can be done sort of thoughtlessly. Yeah, I find that very interesting, but I guess I'm having trouble imagining sort of where this, the pure aim or the equipotentiality itself, like, is it a sort of a temporal moment in the organization of the whole? And then, so like the equipotential would be like the future orientation, which is open. And then the past would be the work that has been performed, with the present, I guess, being the second stage. I don't know. Something about that seems, it's compelling, but I guess I'm still kind of struggling to understand like where exactly that equipotential moment is. In, you know, the organization of the nervous system, for instance.
Yeah, so I think the equipotentiality here would be in the first stage here, I think in this sort of schema that he's giving us in this passage. So when he talks about, for example, the weighing of the two objects, you know, you can decide that, you know, heavier objects are good, you know, for whatever purpose you're doing. For whatever purpose you need the object, you know, you can decide at this moment heavier objects are better, or, you know, for some different purpose maybe lighter objects are better. So this is sort of like the equipotentiality, is that you can decide based on whatever your goals are at the moment, to, you know, prefer lighter or heavier, and then, you know, based on that decision, you would have to, you know, find a way of determining which of these two objects is heavier. And that could be, you know, just sort of picking them up and going by feel and saying, okay, this one feels heavier. And, you know, maybe for some purposes that's adequate. And then in other cases, if your purpose is, you know, some sort of scientific purpose where precise measurement is important, then obviously that, you know, picking up and feeling it is not going to be sufficient. So you would need a scale. You may need to invent a new sort of apparatus that is capable of getting a more precise measurement of weight, etc. So the, you know, going from this initial sort of valuation of heavier is better in this case, towards you know, determining what actual mechanism will be used to identify which of the objects is heavier, you know, including that mechanism just being, you know, your existing nervous system and muscles and capacity to, you know, pick up objects and so on. So the equipotentiality here, I think, comes in because there's nothing that sort of predetermines that you will choose to make the heavy objects the better ones or the preferable ones. Or even if there is, like, in this particular case, there might be some sort of, preset circuit in your nervous system that will sort of guide you towards, that will bring about this selection of the heavier object. But then, you know, you can just go back one step further and you know, determine where that preset circuit came from. You know, there were alternate paths in your life history that could have led towards selecting the lighter object instead, you know, if whatever circumstance had been different, etc. So there's always, like, it goes back to the discussion of the framed mechanism versus framing of the mechanism in the cybernetics book. So there's always some sort of selection of, you know, a certain goal or a certain end to be achieved. And then the mechanism that brings about that end is sort of secondary to that selection of an end. But yeah, so the end itself is not sort of determined by something else that already exists. Yeah, and so, like, this reference to Plotinus, or this, you know, idea that he draws from Plotinus, is that, you know, the nervous system has, of course, or, you know, has these sort of preset circuits built into it. When you're when you're an already formed organism that is encountering a situation and making a decision or taking some sort of action, but the nervous system also, you know, has to develop, and the embryo doesn't itself have a nervous system that, you know, tells the nervous system where to grow, you know, put a nerve here and connect these two organs or whatever. So the nervous system has to sort of form itself, or the embryo has to form itself into a nervous system, I guess is a better way of putting it. the set of pre-existing pathways that a nervous system is the outcome of the sort of selection of ends, rather than being what is doing the selecting. Although secondarily, once the nervous system does exist, then of course the person who is selecting ends does so, you know, using their nervous system. So the end selection comes first, and the means by which that selection happens comes second.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great point. I guess his response to Churchland might be, as you were saying, like, you wouldn't deny that, you know, something like Hebbian learning happens in the brain, but that it has to come about somehow. Like, you don't start with like a blueprint of the weights that you are eventually going to have. There's a kind of a freedom of potential in the ability to instantiate choices, I guess, or to sort of decide how that potential is going to be instantiated, or in those weights themselves. And after that, the organism largely acts via the weights that it has established in that way. It reminds me of Bergson. And, you know, the famous cone. Bergson talks about how the regions of the cone that are closest to matter are like the most automatic regions, whereas the further regions of the cone closer to the base are, for him, more singular and less sort of automatically deployable, I guess. We could draw a parallel between equipotentiality and the base of the cone and the third moment, or the machines and the point of the cone.
Yeah, I feel like I'm just on the edge of this thought that I'm trying to formulate, but this passage, I mean, there's a lot in this paragraph. And his reference to bonds, it kind of makes me want to go back and reread the last chapter to understand that a little bit more, because I feel like I've missed something. But you know, that consciousness is this thing that kind of reaches across two realms, sort of, to create that bond, to bind these, whatever its goal is, it achieves this by binding across these two domains and making a whole, and it does this via the the neuronal structure, I suppose, or you know, the physical structure of the cerebrum, but that. Yeah, I don't know. There's something there, and I hopefully as we read a little bit further in here, that will come together for me. But I feel like he's really trying to get at something that I'm not quite getting here.
Yeah, hopefully it will come together as we continue. Are you ready to read the next bit?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I had to do a few things for my kids real quick. So.
So we're on page 117. Because the absolute domain.
Okay. Great. Great. Yes, and also in this very first paragraph, he's going to reference ENIAC and MARC, the two kind of early first digital computers. Because the absolute domain is the principle of every bond and not the outcome of bonds and of the assemblage of parts, it alone can work. Once built, a calculator supplies the quote-unquote right result much more reliably than humans. But the machine's cogs or circuits are simply simple proxies of improvised cerebral bonds. What we call quote-unquote control in machines, like ENIAC or MARC, that is, the center that guides the opening or closure of circuits, is obviously nothing more than a control in the second degree, passive relative to the will of the manipulator. A very interesting case is the one where the authentic choice made by absolute survey allows, through accumulation, the passage from disorder to order and, thereby, an inversion of entropy's normal direction of evolution toward a maximum. Quote unquote, Maxwell's demon, who chooses the rapid molecules of the molecules of a mixture to make the heat pass from the cold body to the warmer body, or to rediscover the component bodies by starting from a mixture, necessarily presupposes a domain of absolute survey. More generally, where we notice a rise in entropy, as in the biological order, we have to presuppose the existence of domains of absolute survey. This is a new and crucial sign in favor of the fact that the status of absolute domains underlies both organic and psychological phenomena. It is impossible to replace, quote-unquote, Maxwell's demon by a machine with automatic choices, given that a machine can only, quote-unquote, recognize molecules through the physical or chemical action they perform on its organs. The molecule's interesting traits disappear in this very action. This restriction applies to organic machines qua machine. If we were to imagine Maxwell's demon, for example, with eyes like those of the multicellular organism, then they would only be able to observe the molecules through the photoelectric effect, and the obtained information would become obsolete before it was useful. Only an absolute domain, in which knowledge is primary and independent of the observation that results from the interaction between individuals, in which knowledge is identical to auto-subjectivity, in which the component parts of the system are not observed but seized in the absolute unity of the system, can resolve the problem of the rise of entropy. Norbert Wiener noted that it is impossible to observe a given system, a star, for example, that would not obey the same thermodynamics we obey and whose entropy would move toward a minimum instead of going toward a maximum. In an interesting mental experiment, Wiener imagines a star that attracts light instead of radiating it. We obviously cannot observe this star because we can observe the light that arrives but not the light that leaves. Continuing the utopian exercise, we can imagine an intelligent being B, for whom time moves in the opposite direction to our time. For us, A, every communication with B would be impossible, or at least profoundly distorted. Quote, any signal he might send would reach us with a logical stream of consequence from his point of view, antecedent from ours. These antecedents would already be in our experience, and we would have served to us as the natural explanation of his signal, without presupposing an intelligent being to have sent it. If he drew us a square, we should see the remains of his figure as its precursors. and it would seem to be the curious crystallization, always perfectly explainable, of these remains. Its sense would seem to be as fortuitous as the faces we read into mountains and cliffs, end quote. I assume that that last part was a quote from Norbert Wiener about his individual traveling in an opposite direction in time. Yeah, this is interesting. Also, obviously, this is a primitive conception of a black hole referred to there. But yeah, that's really interesting. One thing he seems to be doing a lot in this chapter is just sort of denigrating in his casual way the our strictly material explanation for phenomena that we observe. And here essentially saying we would have missed the so-called intelligence behind the creation of something had it happened in the opposite direction of time. Let's see. And then, of course, he's just talking about Maxwell's demon here, which was the thought experiment. In the 19th century, I believe, around the time that the laws of thermodynamics were established, that Maxwell's demon was this hypothetical demon who could create order out of a disordered system. And I think at the beginning it was assumed to break the second law of thermodynamics, but then it was realized that this demon would actually have to use heat to do the thinking to create this order, and therefore the second law was conserved in this thought experiment.
Yeah, on this topic of thermodynamics here, we were just discussing in that chat. So in the translation, it says a rise of entropy in a few places, and this is kind of this is actually sort of the opposite of what he's trying to say here. But it's partly, I think, the term he uses in French is not super clear. So he talks about remontée d'entropie. And I think the idea here, the sort of the image that he's working with, is that like entropy is sort of flowing downstream, that like you have like a state of high entropy and then a state of low entropy, and the system sort of flows towards the low entropy state. And then he's talking about these, you know, specific cases like in living beings that seem to go sort of upstream, that you know, move into a higher entropy state. From a lower entropy state to a higher entropy state. It is not a rise of entropy, which is, of course, just the normal sort of direction of time in the under the second law of thermodynamics, but it's a sort of swimming upstream of the flow of entropy is what he's sort of getting at. So, it's the low entropy state, you know, returning to a low entropy state or bringing about a low entropy state from a high entropy state is what he's talking about. The Maxwell demon thought experiment would be an instance of this, where, you know, the demon is capable of separating the high velocity particles from the low velocity particles, and then, you know, bringing about a difference in temperature between, say, two sides of a chamber, and then using that to perform work, and then repeating the process, and this would be a, you know, perpetual motion machine. It'd be like as if you could, you know, fill up your car with gasoline and drive around, and then have the car also, you know, refill its gas tank as you're driving, which would be obviously very nice for our wallets, but is not possible. So the Maxwell demon sort of idea was presented first as a kind of potentially like a violation of the second law of thermodynamics, and then eventually I can't remember who first sort of pointed this out, but someone pointed out that the demon would itself have to perform work. It would have to be affected by the particles that were in this chamber. It would have to, you know, receive energy from them, for example, and then it would have to, you know, move the little door back and forth to either let the high velocity particles through or prevent the low velocity particles from passing, etc. So in any case, the demon has to perform work. It can't just sort of purely select the high velocity particles without you know, interacting with the system. And so because it has to perform work, that means it can't, you know, produce a sort of perpetual motion machine, and which is good because we know that perpetual motion machines don't work. But yeah, so in a biological organism, there's something like a Maxwell's daemon, but of course it is, you know, performing work that and requires, you know, input of low entropy sources, like, you know, the chemical bonds in food, for example. It uses these existing, you know, low entropy systems. It you know, breaks down the existing chemical bonds, releases energy, uses that to perform work, and then can, you know, do things like build new tissues, for example. So if you just sort of look at the individual, if you look at the organism itself, you might sort of see it as, you know, swimming up the stream of the flow of entropy. You'll see that, you know, the organism is, you know, growing. It's developing more structure as opposed to, you know, sort of degrading structure over time. But it's only capable of doing that because it's constantly taking in energy from its environment. So the like broader system, organism plus environment, is still, you know, working in the same general arrow of time, you know, from low to high entropy. It's just that in this one particular region, it is, you know, the entropy can decline. But yeah, so he points, Ruyer points out here that this sort of local decline of entropy, this local production of order, is always the result of some kind of absolute survey. So even in the case of, you know, the living being that is producing its own tissues, for example, this is something that has to be understood as a kind of subjectivity in the more general sense. You know, obviously it's not that the egg is sort of picturing the chicken that it wants to turn into, but the sort of directedness towards a goal that is characteristic of this egg as a living entity is a kind of subjectivity in the same way as a person being directed towards a goal is subjectivity. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next bit. Maybe we'll just do one more and then end for today. I'll read the next one. I'll go to the next letter in our list of entities or topics here. The following objection can be raised against Wiener. The living organisms winding up entropy. I'm just going to comment here. Yeah, I think winding up entropy might be a better translation than increasing entropy or whatever it had earlier. I think this is exactly a remonté. So here, remonté is something like you winding up a watch is remonté une montre. So here, of course, the watch as it's, you know, just operating, like after, like when you wind up the watch and then let it run, that is an increase of entropy over time. The watch is going from this low entropy state to a high entropy state as it, you know, unwinds. And then your action, you know, at the end of the day when you wind it back up again is sort of bringing the watch system back into a state of low entropy so that it can perform work over the course of the day, you know, by ticking and demonstrating and, you know, moving the hands and so on. Okay, so I'm going to restart the passage here. The following objection can be raised against Wiener. The living organisms, winding up entropy, realize, in fact, the conditions of his utopia, and yet we can observe them and even observe them by means of a material system, photography, cinema, that obeys ordinary thermodynamics. But this objection is superficial and fails to capture the most crucial and interesting point. It is more accurate to follow N. Wiener's suggestion and to conclude that we cannot, in fact, observe them as living and acting qua organisms with finality. In the organism, finality is not, properly speaking, causality in reverse or the evolution toward minimum entropy. It is a, quote, absolute survey of time, unquote, indifferent to its thermodynamic sense, because the end ideally precedes the means that precede it in the order of the actual. This is precisely why the scientific observation of organisms systematically misrecognizes their finality and has the illusion of causally explaining a finalist action that should be understood by means of survey. every individual action, which is independent of the normal entropic evolution, is in the strict sense inobservable, and the quote-unquote causalist scientist who is confronted with a living organism is indeed like A, who explains the square that B traces by referring back to causes instead of understanding it as a sign, because of his failure to adopt the same direction of time as the being he observes. A living being understands another living being only by placing itself in the finalist perspective, and not in the perspective of mechanism or thermodynamics. Let A and B be the two beings whose thermodynamic time is opposed. And he refers here to figure 39, which is two arrows labeled A and B, which are pointing in opposite directions. So arrow A is pointing downwards, and arrow B is pointing upwards. So these are the two different directions of time. He's taking from Norbert Wiener's example. So what is antecedent for B appears consequent for A, who observes B, and vice versa. B, at moment A prime, decides to trace a square to emit a signal to A, and from moment A prime to moment C prime, the traces of the square are gradually erased by the rise in entropy. But because A goes from moment A to moment C, it sees the square emerge progressively and naturally without presenting any possible meaning other than that of a physical phenomenon determined by natural causes. Let us suppose now that A and B are cunning men, devious diplomats, conducting politics outside their rival countries. They obviously subsist within the same thermodynamic time. He's referring now to figure 40, which is next to figure 39. And so here we have the two arrows going in the same direction. So A and B are both pointing downwards. But then, as he'll explain in a little bit in a couple sentences, there's also a second arrow next to arrow B, which is a sort of dotted line pointing upwards. And so he'll explain what that means in a bit. Let us suppose now that A and B are cunning men, devious diplomats, conducting politics outside their rival countries. They obviously subsist within the same thermodynamic time, arrow in dashes, and now the antecedents, moment A of A, correspond to the antecedents A prime of B. But B can have a secret project that will be revealed at the moment C prime, a project that B prepares with various maneuvers from the moment A prime. These maneuvers are therefore consequent to the project's general theme, and everything takes place as if an arrow A double prime C double prime, which A cannot observe, combined, thanks to the action of conscious calculation, with the arrow A prime C prime, which A can observe. If events erupt, for example, at moment A prime, events resulting in reality from B's A double prime, C double prime project, A may very well attribute them to natural causes and fail to discern in them a sign of B's intentions, exactly as in Wiener's utopian example. He may treat the traces of the square drawn by B in the quote-unquote future as a natural phenomenon that has only causes and no sense. Consider an example. Churchill recounts in his memoirs that he summoned American troops to Ireland from the beginning of 1942 to prepare the landing in North Africa. This arrival was therefore ideally, quote-unquote, consequent to the projected landing, but it was so indecipherable to the adversaries that it did not risk betraying the secret of the operation. So the absolute survey of consciousness and an inversion in the direction of entropy and in the course of thermodynamic time have similar effects. However, if A were very wily and shrewd, he would see through B's maneuvers and surmise his intentions from the first incidents because, through his own consciousness, he would also be independent of the thermodynamic direction AC and could enter into ideal synchrony with A double prime, C double prime, while physiologically living in ordinary physical time. Every living being, quote-unquote, knows beyond what it, quote-unquote, observes, though observation is always easier than knowledge and always risks obstructing the intuition that the nature of consciousness makes possible. Every living being is at once inside physical or thermodynamic time and outside time and the ordinary evolution of entropy. That passage might not have been that intelligible without having the diagram in front of you, just to give a sort of very sort of superficial sort of rephrasing of what he's describing here, it essentially is that, you know, the diplomat who is, you know, pursuing some sort of secret project does so in a sense by sort of reversing the arrow of time. So it's the later state, it's the sort of goal that is at the end that in a sense brings about the initial actions that from the outside or from someone who is not aware of this goal, those initial actions might not even look like they were intended for any particular reason. It might just seem to be, you know, natural events that are just occurring for no reason. And it's only, you know, at the end of this, when this project is revealed that you can sort of retroactively identify, oh, you know, these seemingly innocuous events from 3 years ago were actually, you know, the first steps in preparing this secret plan. So that's sort of like the general idea. And so this, you know, is a sort of specific instance of the kind of thing that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, later actions can retroactively change the sense of earlier actions. But here it's not just, you know, sort of contingently changing the sense of earlier actions, but there's this, you know, from the outset, there's this directedness towards a goal, which makes that goal give sense to what I'm doing now. So we can think of this as sort of like the prospective version of what we were talking about earlier in retrospective terms. So, you know, what I do now can change the meaning of what I did in the past, but also what I do now is itself affected by the goal of what I'm doing, you know, that I may end up realizing in the future.
Yeah, this I definitely want to reread all of this after the reading today. It's really interesting how he's setting up how the absolute influence of our perspective on our kind of cause effect explanations of reality, just bringing into question our basic assumptions of how we explain things.
Yeah, I remember this. He used this example in the cybernetics book as well, of the being that travels the other direction through time. And so, like, if they draw draw a geometric shape, like a square on the sand, then we would see it as the apparently natural accumulation of the sand into the geometric shape of the square. And everything would be explicable by natural processes, except, I guess, the fact that it would just seem extremely unlikely, but not impossible, that sand would just sort of happen to produce this shape. But it makes it clear to me, his discussion of the same example here, sort of how that fits into finalistic behavior generally. I think his point seems to be that even though everything, we can understand everything that goes on in the body of an animal, including a human being, in physiological terms, still sort of the reason that animal is doing what it's doing, you know, the actions that are analyzable in physicochemical terms would be very difficult to explain in physicochemical terms without appealing to something like goal-directed behavior. And so in a sense, the animal is like the being that communicates backwards through time, in that we can sort of the sensible sign of its behavior, completely conforms to kind of step-by-step causality. But the reason for that behavior does not. There's a different level of organization and a different sort of transtemporal level of organization that needs to be taken into account to explain the reason, you know, the signs that we get from the animal follow the sequence that they do.
When he mentions crystallization, this appearance of the square would look like a kind of weird crystallization process. Of course, made me think of Simondon, and maybe the, you know, physical individuation stuff that he's talking about here is really a kind of like the physical individuation in like the crystallization examples in Simondon are can be understood as instances of this, you know, sort of reverse order of time process.
Also, you know, I mean, to think about basically, you know, anything that he so far has called an absolute domain, or the difference between an absolute domain and a non-absolute domain entity, like a cloud formation or something like that. And you know, what is he implying here? Like even for the appearance of you know, an atom, you know, or a molecule, which he ascribes an absolute domain. You know, I don't know, just the implications of all of this for that there is some, you know, underlying conscious or you know, whatever you want to call it, activity underlying their formation and their being. I don't know. It's something interesting to think about here.
Yeah, and like even in the case of physics, like thermodynamics has to do with, you know, collections of particles, you know, like collections of atoms or molecules or whatever. But thermodynamics doesn't tell you anything about the what an individual atom does over time. You know, how the atom's states evolve over time, etc. Yeah, and so the sort of evolution of a whole collection of atoms, you know, say in a cloud of gas that, you know, moves towards the high entropy state over time. Yeah, this is it doesn't tell you anything about what any one of those atoms will do, except insofar as, you know, you can predict based on the evolution of the whole cloud of atoms what the, say, like the average velocity will end up being at the end of the evolution through time, but that doesn't tell you anything about a specific individual atom. And yeah, so this I think is a sort of illustration reflects the difference that Rie is talking about between a true form like an atom, which is, you know, not a thermodynamic system, and the aggregates like the gas cloud, which are thermodynamic systems.
Yeah, and this may just be my naivete speaking here, but you know what I love about this, and you know, I mean, because I'm still fairly new to really diving into to this kind of philosophy at this level, is that, you know, on the surface, all of these claims, it could just be kind of, oh, you know, these are just really fun, mystical, like, ooh, that's neat, like an atom is conscious or whatever. But, you know, I mean, he's really throughout the book just so clearly laid out his sort of ontological foundation for these claims and given them, you know, enough depth to where there's a lot more to that statement than, you know, just kind of, you know, the woo-woo posters or whatever you might see. And I don't know, I just love it. It's so great.
Yeah, I think you could almost put it like the other way around, is that like it's not so much just the point here is not so much to say that atoms are conscious, but that consciousness is like an atom. It may be even at least as much what he's saying here as the other way around.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Right. Okay. So yeah, I think we're pretty close to the 2-hour mark here. And we're at this, well, break in the itemization, this list of items that he's going through here. So yeah, we can pause here. And yeah, we'll pick up from there next time.